The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
There's an argument being made increasingly forcefully in the United States that American democracy is being reshaped by an extraordinary concentration of wealth and power. Economist Jeffrey Sachs has been talking about the influence of America's richest individuals and the extent to which a handful of billionaires can now shape elections, public policy, as well as media and financial institutions. And it raises a very basic question. If enormous wealth buys enormous political influence, how democratic is the system actually at the moment? This is Sachs speaking on the Buy Side Wall Street Journal podcast.
Already the 10 richest Americans have $2.3 trillion of wealth. That's a lot for 10 people, 10 individuals. That's not 10 companies. That's not 10 clans. That's 10 people. But they also happen to own a lot more. They own the White House. They installed the vice president. They determine U.S. government policy. They will own the cryptocurrencies, which will become our main currencies. They own all of the big platforms on which we communicate. They own YouTube, of course, which is the channel where I'm able to say sometimes things that are not in the U.S. government's liking, but I don't know for how long. They own my email address. They own the full knowledge of every keystroke I've made in the last 10 years, no doubt. They own my privacy. They own the newspapers like the Washington Post, owned by Jeffrey Bezos. They will own TikTok shortly, TikTok USA, because Larry Ellison is buying it on behalf of Benjamin Netanyahu, and Ellison will give it to his son as a nice gift. He's already given to his son Paramount Studios, Paramount Media, and CBS News. It's quite a world.
It's quite a world. Indeed, it is, according to Jeffrey Sachs. Well, I'm joined now by Larry Donnelly, NUIG Law Lecturer, University of Galway is its official title now, columnist with the Journal.ie, Scott Lucas, Professor and Political Analyst at the Clinton Institute at University College Dublin, and Marion McKeown, multi-award-winning journalist, broadcaster and podcaster. Good morning and welcome, one and all. I'm welcoming you to New Ross, but you're here already for the JFK Summer School, all of you. So anyway, it's great to have you. Let's talk about money and politics, first of all. Scott.
It's not new.
It's not new.
Wealth in politics goes back to the earliest days of the Republic, but I think what's different now in 2026 to kick it off is two things. One thing is that the rules of the game have gone. Now, by rules of the game, I mean you can accumulate wealth in ways where you're not regulated at all now. So the rise of crypto and that distortion it's causing both to the U.S. and the global system is important. The increased concentration of media ownership amongst a few people linked to the president. You heard the references to Larry Ellison, for example, close friend. You could talk about more broadly Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk. And then I think the second factor here is, and just need to be very honest here, is that there used to be rules of the game that whatever money there was in U.S. politics, the president couldn't profit from that. Mm. You had to have that impression of being above, basically.
But before we carry on with this analysis, I'm wondering about how every congressman, it would appear, and every senator who are on modest enough salaries are, so many of them, so very rich. How? Where, how are they making their money?
You know, inside information is power and information is money.
So are they insider trading all the time?
I would not use that specific word, inside trader, because I've got a lawyer across from me.
Yeah, I'd be very careful to say that, as Scott said.
But a generality, a lot of them are much more wealthy than their salaries could explain.
What I will say is that it's manifestly clear that they are profiting from their position. I think that there is no denying that reality. If you look at the bank accounts, you look at the details, they are profiting from where they sit.
Because, you know, sometimes you see an external view on television of a congressman's home or a senator's home, and you say, my God, look at that spread. That's fabulous. Wealth beyond the dreams of avarice. And then it turns out that they don't have private money. So how do they get that house?
Oh, you know, if you want to go into the details, the fact here is, and Larry, again, as a lawyer, will know this Marion's witnessed it as a journalist. There are ways to work within the system, but in a sense bend the rules for that accumulation of wealth. And if we could take it back to Donald Trump technically will tell you he does not profit at all because he went into a blind trust. His sons run the businesses. But one fact alone to tell you about the changed environment is that Trump made $2.4 billion from cryptocurrency last year. Compare that with Trump's first term when we were just sort of talking about whether he made $1.5 million from his hotels. And that tells you how much the scale of the problem has changed, in part because this is a transactional presidency.
Does nobody shout stop because they're all at it? Larry.
I think that's part of it. I mean, look, in lots of ways in American politics, and we want to talk about the faults of American politics, much of it comes down to the fact that we have an objectively crazy two-party system for a country of 350 million people and two parties who collude in what is a mutually beneficial environment. And these are some of the sad, unfortunate truths. And, of course, money is at the root of it, but it's a bigger societal issue because money runs America. I know money runs the world, but in America, it's palpable. And the sad truth is that the inequality in the United States, and this is since I was a kid to now, the inequality in the United States, every time I go back, it's absolutely palpable. It's in your face. It is the biggest problem of all the problems that America faces. That is the biggest problem. And do I see a way out? Unfortunately, I don't, because as was in Jeffrey Sachs, who I don't agree with on a lot of things, but he made the good point about the concentration of wealth. Mm. And when you have people with that much wealth, that much power, they're not going to give it up easy.
Now, Marion, the question of not doing anything about it, you hope, and the fervent hope was when Trump started out at the beginning of his second term, he started these executive orders and started to do things that hadn't been done before, doing things to the Department of Justice, putting utterly unqualified people in. And you would expect maybe the courts will shout stop. But at the very top is I suppose a corrupt Supreme Court, because there are people there have been accused of being on the take, and there are people who certainly are not just looking at the law, they're looking at political bias in making their decisions.
Yeah, you know, I think that the Supreme Court have seen in Donald Trump a completely imperfect vehicle, but a vehicle nonetheless that will do the job of getting their ideology and getting the sort of America that a lot of the supermajority want to see through. So they're willing to cut him a lot of slack where they have no business cutting him slack. And an example of that was the ruling, the Trump versus USA, where they said, absolutely rewriting the Constitution almost, that a president has absolute immunity for any official acts. He cannot be prosecuted criminally for any official acts. This, it was because Nixon before said, if the president does it, it's not illegal. And everybody laughed.
Everybody laughed. Yeah, and he was the one himself in the 2016 campaign who said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and I would get away with it.
Now, he meant that as a candidate and that he was so beloved that his base would never, but now the Supreme Court has effectively made it so. If he could argue, I did it as part of my official duty. So you have this system where, as you said, you have Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, who by any objective metric are hopelessly compromised. They've taken gifts from multi-billionaires, they've taken free travel, they've taken millions of dollars worth of stuff. You have John Roberts, who has presided over decisions that have gutted the Voting Act, that are inexplicable by any logic. You know, the ideology of overturning things like Roe v. Wade, that was something that they wanted for a long time. As I said, Trump was the imperfect vehicle for that. But what they've done in the recent decisions about the Voting Act, the gerrymandering, it seems that they see Trump and they are willing to do his bidding. The election.
When you said gerrymandering, I mean, the United States is gerrymandered every 10 years.
Depending
on who's in power, the lines are drawn. What was unusual about this gerrymandering, it was a midterm gerrymandering. Yeah. But gerrymandering is accepted as a fact of life. Those in power get to draw the lines, which is barking mad.
Absolutely. You know, we talked about money being the big problem, but gerrymandering is also a big problem. And look, it's patently undemocratic. The fact that, you know, it's done on a partisan basis is frankly ridiculous. I can understand why people the world over look at the American system and say this is absolute madness. And, you know, both parties have been guilty of it. But I have to say Republicans have made it into a fine art form, to be frank, the way that they have gerrymandered districts to their advantage. And one of the real problems with gerrymandering is it creates safe districts and it encourages candidates from both parties to go harder to the left and harder to the right, rather than having candidates who in districts would have to fight it out and would come to the middle, to come to the consensus, where, again, despite the fact that there's a narrative around polarization in America, which is largely true if we look at elected officials, the majority of Americans, if you look at the polling, they remain somewhere in that murky middle, and they are not represented. And that's why the midterms are going to be, for many Americans, a least bad option election.
Okay, so they might get someone who will actually fight for their cause, whatever that cause might be, because at the moment that is simply not happening. Those safe seats, it's a strange situation where people can be in Congress, be it in the Senate or the House of Representatives, for decades without any serious challenge. And that's because of gerrymandering.
It is, and it's also because of money. Because when somebody's in office long enough, they actually become a cottage industry. And their staffers from an early stage, they go into lobbying, they go into different roles. They make their living based on their connection to that individual who's been around forever. So don't kill the golden goose. Keep him or her in office as long as they can.
I'm getting depressed here.
Don't. Because we're taking it from a view on high, and I share that. But if you take it at a view at local and state level, it's a little bit different. And remember, these elections in November will be very much in some ways local elections for House Representatives. This has actually been the worst year for incumbents in primaries. Mm-hmm. And sure. The reason for that,
despite and that includes Democrats, not just
Republicans. Oh, yeah. And the reason why you say that is that for two reasons. One is, of course, Trump has taken over the Republican Party, which has knocked out a lot of Republican incumbents. But on the Democratic side, what you have is you have what I think is a healthy debate amongst Democrats in terms of after the 24 debacle, where they go next. And I think if you take issues that matter to people, such as health care, such as transport, education, the fundamentals of being accountable, which you brought up, you're seeing people say, look, we're not just going to stick with the system as is.
Marion, Trump's habit of name-calling, I mean, whether he was mocking someone with a disability or whether he was deriding little Marco Rubio with the small feet and the large shoes, all of that sort of thing, is that not working anymore? I mean, he's tried to label various people as commies, as vegans in the case of Tallarico in Texas. Is that wearing off, that effect?
Yes, and I think for two reasons. I think, first of all, he's just not very good at it anymore. Before, he was effective as a schoolground bully in that he would say things that were occasionally funny. I remember when he called Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas. It was juvenile, it was childish, but she was claiming a very nebulous...
Dubious,
let's say, Indian ancestry. So it was, and it stuck. And it did damage her, because then people would think of her and they think Pocahontas. He's just not good at it anymore. He's lost a step. I think it's a sign or a symptom maybe of his mental degeneration, that the barbs don't land anymore. They just sound stupid. They sound his trolling, like Lake America, Lake Ontario. People are just rolling their eyeballs, even within the Republican Party. Now he just sounds, as I say, Trump is no longer effective. It's not just that he's entering a lame duck, the era of his presidency. I think he's just no longer effective because people have seen that he did not only do the things he said he'd do, which was to lower price and keep America out of foreign wars. He's done the exact opposite.
Why, the man is wilting, there's no question about it, falling asleep in the middle of speeches in the Oval Office, which, boring though they might be, he should be at least awake people speaking. But the question of who, the people he surrounds himself with, like, I'm looking for a term for the American system at the moment. Is it an autocracy? It's heading that way. Is it a kleptocracy? Certainly it is. Is it an idiocracy? Because he is surrounded by idiots.
Yeah, I'd go cakeistocracy, which is the government of the least effective, the worst of the worst. I think that we have a cakeistocracy at the moment in America. When you look at people like Pete Hegseth, when you look at Todd Blanche, these are people who are just not ineffective. They're incompetent. They're corrupt, and they're willing to do whatever Trump's bidding is. So I think there is a lot of authoritarian creep at the moment that's being enabled by the Supreme Court, incredibly, but also by the people who work for Trump and by the Republican Party. And it has to be said, the Democrats have been pretty apathetic in their bid to resist all this. I think the one group, and I like Scott, I'm optimistic, I think civil society is doing more than any other group in America to keep America in some kind of a democracy. I think that you've got some terrific people working at grassroots level who are doing incredible things.
Now, Larry, the institutional damage that has been done, I mean, besides internationally where you pull out of the WTO, you stop funding the United Nations efforts, USAID is stopped, all those kind of things. Besides that, within the United States, I mean, whenever I saw, you know, the FBI and I watch on television a program about you, and I'm saying, good on you guys, you're the good guys. Kash Patel's in charge, and I don't know whether they're honest or, you know, can they be trusted at all?
No, the damage that Trump has done by stretching the powers of the executive branch to their very limits, the damage that he has done is going to take some time to undo.
Can it be reversed? Or
it can, but I'll tell you one thing that doesn't get reported on enough, and this is, to my view, we always talk about, and we're taught the three co-equal branches of government in the United States. To my view, the constitutional design is actually that the Congress, the legislative branch, is actually the supreme branch of the three. And what we've seen in recent years on a whole host of different topics and issues in fora is that the legislative branch has ceded its authority in many, many occasions, both to the executive branch and to the judiciary.
But can it seize it back?
It can, but is it minded to do so? That's the question.
Isn't the whole system based on the Constitution utterly flawed? I mean, two senators per state. So you've got a populous state like New York, a populous state like California.
Larry's rolling his eyeballs here.
I know the reasons for it at the beginning, so that those without a voice would be heard. I know that. I understand. But it does seem like it's completely anomalous now.
But there are two houses, one of which operates on the basis of population. The other operates on the basis that there are 50 states. Don't forget, the United States is a vast country. If you were to look at it, it is actually more analogous to the European Union than to any single member state of the European Union. Each state needs to have that level of representation.
As we have.
Exactly. I don't think Irish people would like it if it was basically denuded of power because of its population.
I think these topics about the Senate, about the Electoral College, which we've discussed before, I think these are topics, when the fire is put out, that we'll have to come back to. But I want to come back to something I told you in spring of 2025, Pat, in studio. The house is on fire. That was the first time, and I remember why. It was issues over the threats against millions of immigrants, including against people coming into the United States. It was the attempt to take over the Justice Department as Trump's personal fiefdom, the corruption of the FBI, as you mentioned. And I said, this is a wannabe authoritarian regime.
And we're heading there.
We are there. And the question is whether we can get back from it.
All right. On that slightly optimistic note, we have to leave it. Do you want to say anything briefly, Mary?
I do. I'm going to continue my argument with Larry because I'm a passionate believer that the Electoral College should go and that the Senate should be more representative. And my what I always say to Larry is Wyoming, 500,000 people, two senators, California, 40 million. Two senators. Make it make sense.
California, 53 congressmen. Wyoming, one.
All right, we leave it there. Larry Donnelly, lecturer in law in University of Galway, columnist of the Journal.ie. Scott Lucas, professor and political analyst at the Clinton Institute at UCD. And Maren McKeown, multi-award-winning journalist, broadcaster and podcaster. Thank you all very much.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
With Timber Living Log Cabins.